stories illustrate that. We had a case from the office that we were challenging the blue laws of Pennsylvania.
And the blue laws are?
Blue laws are the laws at the time, maybe they still exist to some extent, that prohibited the doing of business on Sunday, except for certain types of business. So that if you had a supermarket, you could not open on Sunday. But if you had a stand with 10 or 12 stools, I forget the number, where you serve food, you could open on Sunday. And if you had that in a supermarket, inside of a supermarket, then you could open the supermarket on Sunday. And we were trying to hold the blue laws unconstitutional. And I was working with Mr. Eckert on this. And he gave me two assignments. One was go out and give me a memo on every case in the United States that has ever considered the constitutionality of the blue laws under any state or federal jurisdiction. Which, as you might imagine, is a rather broad assignment. The other one was, I think he limited it to every case since 1900, something like that. This is 1961, too. The other assignment was give me a second memo giving every federal and state constitutional reason why you think the blue laws might be held unconstitutional. I took the first memo into Mr. Eckert. It ran 70 pages, perhaps, typewritten, and handed it to him. He handed it back to me the next morning, and he said, if you go through there, you'll notice certain marks. If you fix those points, then come back in, we can talk about this. And I went through, and in these 70 pages, there were three or four misspellings or punctuation errors. And there were a couple of places where he had circled the word because he didn't think that was the appropriate word. And he wanted me to go back, he was teaching a young lawyer a lesson. He wanted me to go back and have those corrected and then come back and talk with him about it. Mr. Eckert used to do things like write a brief and say, and then give you an assignment, read this section of the brief, and I know there must be a case that will support this proposition. Go find me the case that supports what I've written. Those kinds of assignments. On the other hand, Mr. Siemens gave me an assignment early on for Mount Lebanon, and I don't remember what it was, and I walked in a couple days later with a 10 or 12 page memo to hand him, and he said, tell me what your conclusion is. And I started to tell him the conclusion, and he turned around, he said, keep talking, and he's dialing a number, and I get two lines out on my conclusion, and Mr. Siemens has on the phone the township manager of Mount Lebanon, and he says, I'm going to put you on the speakerphone. We have concluded that, and he proceeds to discuss the memo that he has not read, and the conclusion that he has heard only two lines of with the manager of Mount Lebanon. Totally opposite personality. Carl Chern was yet a third personality. Carl Chern graduated number one in his class from Harvard Law School and was a whiz in tax. No matter how well you prepared, Carl was always three questions ahead of the most advanced question that you thought could possibly be asked. Different kind of an experience to sit down with Carl Chern in his field of tax and report to him on the results of your taxes. And you learn something from each one. But probably the best teacher of them was Mel Malott. When you did a contract for Mel, and Mel did a lot of contracts for Mel, he would have you come in and he would go through the contract with you sitting there, making his corrections and explaining why he was changing language. And I learned a lot about how to write, how to draft from Mel Malott. So each one of them in a different way.
You were very fortunate to learn from all of them.
All of us then were uh-huh. very fortunate. When I first came to the firm, about a third of the firm was Harvard graduates, and about a third were Pitt graduates, all of whom had graduated either number one or two in their class. And the other people were a couple of other law schools, Dickinson, University of Pennsylvania. And up until 1970, or thereabouts, if you didn't graduate in the top two or three in your class, or from Harvard Law School, your chances of getting an offer from the firm were almost zero. There were one or two exceptions in all those first 10 years I was with the firm. Nobody could maintain that today, and you don't try. Probably have people from 50 law schools today. But in the early days of the firm, that was the standard where the firm, operated.
Did you have one person that you felt was more of a mentor?
Well, I came to the firm because of, Zeke Siemens. He's the one who interviewed me, and he's the one who brought me back here for the subsequent interviews. And I used to do a lot of work for Zeke. But over the years, if I had anyone who was a mentor, it was Mel Malott. Probably did more work for Mel than anyone else. Certainly until I got into the nuclear area, I thoroughly did more work for Mel than anyone else. And Mel Malott was just a great teacher. We were just down in Florida this weekend for our firm members retreat. Mel is the only living named partner, and he gave the talk at the dinner. This is our 40th anniversary of the firm. And Tom Wright, who is now the president and CEO of the firm, remarked also on his early experiences with Mel. And the same things that Tom said there are what I'm saying here now. It's remarkable how all of us remember the same thing. But in the early years, when I took the Pennsylvania bar exam, because I already was a member of the Ohio bar when I moved to Pittsburgh. And I had to take the Pennsylvania bar exam. And I took the bar exam in January or February of 1962. And when the results came out, in those years they announced the number one, two, and three person in the state. And I passed Pennsylvania bar exam number one in the state when I took the Pennsylvania bar exam. Carl Barger, who was also an associate when I first came to the firm and later became partner and ultimately managing partner in the firm until he died, then was a partner again and then passed away, unfortunately, when he was about 62. Carl Barger had also been number one in the state when he had taken the bar exam some two or three years earlier. Well, when the results were announced, Mr. Eckert called me into his office, and he said, "I want to congratulate you on your fine showing on the bar. Now, if you work hard and you keep your health, you should have a good many years of fine practice." And that was the congratulations from Phil Eckert. I mean, that was typical of Mr. Eckert. But one interesting story from the early days. When we moved here, at first Terry didn't have a job, and then she got a job working at the University of Pittsburgh in their health law center as a Flexerider operator. And she went back to Pitt in order to get her degree. And after she was working full-time going to school at Pitt, and I think it was the second year that we were here, she took a Spanish course at 8 o'clock in the morning, five mornings a week. We lived just beyond the university. She needed a language course to graduate. She took Spanish. And so we would get up in the morning, and I would drop her off, or
She'd get off the trolley there, and I would come into work, and I was getting into work every morning that year. I think it was the second year I was here, at about 8:15 in the morning. Mr. Eckert had a habit when he came in the morning, and he used to come in early. He'd get in about 8:30, 8:20. And he had a habit, instead of going directly to his office, we were in the Porter Building and our offices were in a U-shape, and he could have gone to the left and gone directly to his office, he would go to the right and make a tour of the office to see who was in the office. And so for a full year, I was getting into the office about 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes ahead of Mr. Eckert. And for a full year, he would pass by my office and see that I was in the office 5 days a week, every morning early. I think from that year, this had to be 1962, 63, until the day that he died in the early 1980s, Mr. Eckert thought that I was an early riser, came into the office raring to go very early on. I'm sure that had something to do with my good relationship with him, because he thought, boy, I've never seen anybody, because frequently I was the first one in, unless somebody had some litigation or something going on. Spanish class at the University of Pittsburgh is something that I have a great debt to.
Did he ask you why you weren't here the next year?
No, what used to happen would be he would come in the next year, and of course he'd make the circle, and periodically you do get in early, but I mean, so sometimes he would see me there. And one time I remember there was a call, we didn't have call waiting in those days, there was a call, a voicemail, there was a call, and he left a note on my desk. Please see me when you come in. I went down to his office as soon as I came in, which happened that day to be late. It was about 9:15 that I got in, so I was really late. I was supposed to get in at 8:45. And Mr. Eckert said, how did your meeting go? And I didn't know what he was talking about, but I said, I thought he was talking about the meeting the prior day, and I said, fine. He said, I like to see young men scheduling early morning meetings. He thought, obviously, that the reason I was so late was that I had had an early morning meeting, right. And he just made that assumption. So I think he assumed that, I don't know that he ever knew that I was there early because of the Spanish class at Pitt. I never
didn't
told him that story.
What kind of law did you really like the most?
Well, when I started out, I thought I wanted to, I might want to be a litigator, but I soon found, because I had tried 150 court-martial cases in the Air Force, including some very serious felonies, but I soon found that, while that was not unenjoyable, that I liked working on negotiating contractual work a lot better, and corporate work a lot better than that. And so I was sort of heading in that direction when a fluke got me into nuclear law.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was sitting in my office in the Porter Building one day.
And about what year would
this would have been 1965, I guess. And maybe 66, I think 65. And I had been with the firm about 4 or 5 years, and Mr. Siemens called me in his booming voice. He almost didn't need a telephone, and then he called me and he said, what are you doing for a living today? That's how he started out the conversation. That was typical Steve Siemens. And I said, well, I'm working on a contract matter for Mr. Malott. And he said, do you think you could interrupt it to go to a meeting out at a place called Penn Center? And I said, yes, I think I could do that. He said, why don't you come down to my office and I will tell you all about it. So I promptly went down to his office, and it's now about 9:45 or 9:50, and he said, we're representing Westinghouse in a contract dispute. that they have with a utility called Carolina Power and Light Company. And it revolves around a nuclear plant. And I'm the principal person handling it, Mr. Seaman said, and Bob McCartney, who is one of our associates, is the associate working on it. And they're having a meeting at this place called Penn Center to discuss the facts, but I can't make it today. And Bob McCartney's also tied up, and we need to have somebody to go to cover the meeting. And we'd like you to go to cover the meeting. I said, well, I can do that. Tell me a little bit more about it. And he said, well, it's going to last a couple of hours. And when you're done with the meeting, you don't have to say anything or do anything. You just take good notes, come back, report to me, and then you can go back to making a living however it was you were making a living before. So I said, fine, are there any documents? He said, that I should look at first. And he said, no, we don't have any documents. Whatever's out there, you'll see there. And I said, when does the meeting start? And he looks at his watch and he said, it starts in 10 minutes. You're not going to make it on time. You're already going to be late. So I got in my car. Oh, I asked him where Penn Center was. He says, you go out and here are the instructions. And he had some written instructions. And I got out and I got on the parkway and drove out to Penn Center, which was out towards Monroeville in Wilkins Township, where Sears was at the time. And I walk into this conference room and there's a conference table. It's at the end of a hallway. There's a conference table in this conference room which has no windows, and there are 11 people sitting in the conference room and one empty chair. I'm about 15, 20 minutes after 10 o'clock. And the person running the meeting, I didn't know a soul in the room, the person running the meeting looks up and says, this looks like the late lawyer. And I introduced myself. He mentioned his name, nobody else mentions their name, and we sit down, I pull out my yellow pad, and I start writing notes like mad. We get to about 10 minutes of 12, and the person running the meeting says, and I'm still writing, and I've got pages of yellow pad notes, and they've passed out a couple of pieces of paper, and he said, let's see what the lawyers think. And I said, pardon me? He said, well, the question is, can we get out of this option? Westinghouse had entered into a contract to sell a nuclear plant at a fixed price to Carolina Power and Light. It was a turnkey contract. And they had given Carolina Power and Light an option to sell a second nuclear plant, to buy a second nuclear plant. And the question I was being asked was, can we get out of the option? Because it turned out that the price Westinghouse had quoted Carolina Power and Light for the plant and for the option was too low, because a subcontractor to Westinghouse who had been foisted on them by Carolina Power and Light had raised their contract price to Westinghouse. And I said, I think you can get out of the option. And the person running the meeting said, but? And I said, no buts. I think we can devise a strategy that can get you out of the option. And he said, I've never heard an attorney give an unqualified opinion like that. And I said something like, well, I use the word I think we can. And we go back to the meeting, lunch is brought in. The meeting's supposed to end at 12, what Mr. Seaman said. Lunch is brought in, it goes on to 2 o'clock when the meeting breaks, and I get in the car and drive back downtown to report to Mr. Siemens. And I walk into his office and he said, I don't know what advice you gave them, but you better be right. They want you there again tomorrow morning at 8:30 when the meeting resumes. And that's how I got into the nuclear business.
Wow.
The Westinghouse eventually got out of the option on the theory that I thought about right there at the meeting. That strategy was the strategy we put in place. The person who chaired the meeting,
Kirby,
was Ted Stern. Ted Stern at that time was U.S. Projects Manager for Westinghouse. He eventually rose to be the Vice Chairman of the Board. There were at least five people in that room who later became vice presidents of either Westinghouse or other major corporations in this country. And literally that was how I first got into the nuclear business, doing nuclear work for Westinghouse, was from that experience, and that was that, and then one thing led to another. And
tell us more about the whole nuclear business.
Well, in the 1960s, up till 1973, until the Arab oil shock, power plant sales were very strong in this country. The demand for electricity in the United States doubled every 7 years, beginning in the 19-teens, up until 1973. Nuclear power was seen as a very inexpensive way to generate electricity. Westinghouse was the technological leader. The people they had at Westinghouse in the 1960s and 70s in the nuclear business were some of the sharpest, most outstanding people I've ever worked with.
Can you tell some of their names?
Well, they had a fellow named Jim Cermak, Dr. Jim Cermak. Jim Cermak was a specialist in two-phase flow, fluid flow. He was one of the great experts in the world in this subject. He later taught at UCLA Engineering School and then founded his own company. We had a hearing in the early 1970s that involved all of the suppliers of nuclear plants in the U.S., rulemaking hearing, and when we were planning on this hearing, one of them, we got together in a meeting, which we were allowed to do, and one of them came said to me, "Are you planning to call Jim Cermak as a witness on behalf of Westinghouse?" And I said, "I think so, but I'm not sure. Why are you asking?" And he said, "Because if you call Jim Cermak as a witness, we're not going to put on any, none of the rest of us are going to put on any fluid flow experts. We will all stand on his testimony." That's how outstanding this guy is.
How do you spell his last name?
C-E-R-M-A-K. He was a relative of the mayor of Chicago who was shot at and injured in the assassination attempt out in, he was standing next to the president. But anyway, Cermak, Jim Cermak was one. Jim Moore was another. Jim Moore was the boy wonder at Westinghouse. He had gone to school, I think, at Pitt or Carnegie Mellon, and while he was there, he was on fellowship at Westinghouse. And while he was still in engineering school, he designed the fuel for the nuclear reactor in Japan. He later rose all the way to be vice president of the nuclear of the energy business unit at Westinghouse. He was. The business was a very young business. In 1971, in December of 1971, we became involved in a hearing that lasted through 1972 and 70, part of 73, 126 hearing days, to set the rules for a certain aspect of nuclear power. And I went out in 1971 to meet with the Westinghouse people who were going to be involved in this very major, very important hearing. Jim Moore was to be our lead person. In 1971, I was 37 years old. I went out, and there were about a dozen people in the room. I had one of my associates with me, and there may have been 14 people in the room. They were all the people who were going to help us on this hearing. I only knew about four or five of the people. The rest I didn't know, so I had them all introduce themselves. Tell me who they were and so forth. I was 37. Half the people in the room, they were all managers at Westinghouse, every single one of them. Half the people in the room were under the age of 30, and I was the second oldest person in the room. There was one manager who was about 3 years older than I was. Jim Moore was about 32 at the time, and he was going to head this effort. It was all young people, all top-notch scientists and engineers, and I could name a whole bunch of others who were involved at that that time. So the business was new. The Westinghouse was selling, by the end of the 60s, they were selling 25 to 30 reactors a year. They were talking in the United States about having 1,000 nuclear reactors in this country. We have about 110 now. The early work that I did from 64 or 5 from this Carolina Power and Light experience until about 1970 was contract work. In the late 60s, licensing of the plants and it became an issue. Westinghouse was looking for somebody who could help them in the licensing area. There were no such people around, so they looked for somebody who knew something about nuclear plants. Obviously, I knew something about the plants by then, and so I became gradually into the licensing area. And I, over the years, was involved in the licensing of maybe 35 of the U.S. nuclear plants, and probably involved in about 8 or 10 foreign plants. They don't license the same way, but in various issues related to those, those plants. By 1970, I was doing almost nothing except nuclear work. About 10% of my time was being spent on non-Westinghouse, non-nuclear work by then. And that continued until about 1977. What happened in 1977 was Jimmy Carter was elected president. And the oil embargo had changed the demand for electricity and therefore changed the order structure. And we had had some major rulemakings planned and were doing some other things, and Jimmy Carter brought them all to a halt. And so a big hole opened up in my schedule then, and I worked on an antitrust case because we were screaming for antitrust help on this major gypsum case for Georgia-Pacific to fill some time. By then I was doing about 40% nuclear work. And after that, I went to Zeke Siemens and I said, you know, I don't think the nuclear business is going to come back to support the kind of effort we had had. Because in the early 70s, when we had perhaps 65 or 70 lawyers, we had a half a dozen of them working on nuclear work. About 10% of all the firm's work was in nuclear work. But I told them I didn't think it was going to come back. We were looking to start a labor department. We had no departments. We were looking to start a labor group. And I told them I would go back and retrain and become involved in the labor area. And so I did that. A lot more to it than that, but I did that. And formed the first formal group within the firm, which was a labor group, in 1978 or so, and laid out a plan to as to how we were going to expand the labor area. And the plan worked after a fashion, but by 1980 or 81, two things had happened. One, it was clear that some clients, including Westinghouse and Alcoa primarily, were never going to accept me as a labor lawyer because they saw me as a nuclear or contract lawyer. Alcoa saw me as a contract lawyer, Westinghouse saw me as a nuclear lawyer. So if we were ever going to get any labor work from them and the spin-offs that they can give, we had to bring somebody else in. And second, the nuclear stuff started to pick up unexpectedly. So I went back to Zeke Siemens and suggested a lateral move. And we brought in 1980 or 81 the first lateral hire that the firm had brought in since the very first days of the firm. Took us 6 months to do it, a fellow named Al Vadney, and he came to take over the labor area. Now, I had known Al when he had been a lawyer at Westinghouse. He had been a labor lawyer at Westinghouse. Westinghouse needed somebody to handle the nuclear stuff. They tried to make him into a nuclear lawyer. I got to know him for about 8 months. He said, I've had enough of this nuclear nonsense. And he went off to private practice so he could get back to labor. So Al came back to our firm from private practice in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and took over the labor department. And I gradually got more and more back into the nuclear area. 1981, I was made the chairman of the Lawyers Committee of the Industries Trade Association, the Atomic Industrial Forum. I held that position for about 8 years. And in the 1980s, there was a big push to change the way we regulate and license nuclear plants in this country. And a lot of that push was driven by the Congress. And so I spent a lot of my time working on congressional testimony and testifying before the Congress, both the House and the Senate, in connection with the need to change the licensing process and so forth. I probably testified 6 or 8 times before various congressional committees. One of them is very memorable. The others I don't remember much of, but one of them is very memorable. In 1986, the Congress decided to have one of the committees of the House decided to have a hearing on public participation in the licensing process.